Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Richard Forsten, and with me is my colleague Whitney Deeney on behalf of the appellant New Singular, also known as AT&T, and I'll refer to them as AT&T. It is also, a pleasure for me to be here today, not only in front of a panel of three members of the Court, but also in front of a panel of many who probably would like to be justices of the Court. It's certainly a unique experience. This case presents two questions on appeal, but ultimately it hinges on that classic cliche of not in my backyard. And by that I mean today we live in a 21st century where cell phones are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And everybody needs one and uses them all the time, to the point where the FCC on its website estimates that 70% of all 911 calls are made using cell phones. Smartphones, iPads, tablets, they didn't even exist back in 2004 and 2005 when AT&T first started this process. That's how long it's been going on. So my point is simply this. People want cell phones. They need cell phones. They just don't like cell towers that come with them. Now, the two issues presented by this appeal are fairly straightforward. The first is a purely legal question, and that is whether the Board of Adjustment applied the correct legal standard in reviewing this request for a special exception. The statute or the code requires, if you're an applicant who wants to put up a cell tower, that you have to meet certain technical requirements. You have to be set so far back from the property line based on the height of your tower. You have to demonstrate there's a need for the tower. You have to demonstrate that there's no other structures in the area where you could put your equipment. Obviously, Sussex County Council wants folks to share towers as much as possible. And then you have to show that your proposed use does not, quote, substantially affect adversely the uses of adjacent neighboring properties.
Right, the duel here is over the word substantially, correct?
That is correct.
And your contention is that that has to have some independent meaning, otherwise why would it be there? And my question is, if it does have an independent meaning, what is the content of that meaning? Does it relate, and how would it affect the result in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think County Council, Sussex County Council, could have easily just said there can't be any adverse effects. It didn't say that. It said there can't be any substantial adverse effects. And it used that word recognizing that for any proposed use of a property adjacent to another property, you could always gin up some sort of adverse effect. And there's a balancing that's going on here, particularly in the case of cell phone towers, because as I kind of recited in the litany, the public needs cell phone tower service, needs cell service at this point with technology the way it is and society the way it is.
Well, what is the definition of the phrase that you would have us apply?
Well, I think substantially affect adversely is the phrase, and that means that the effect has to be substantial. I mean, that's what the word is. It has to be more than fleeting. It has to be more than innocuous. It's got to have...
Going back to your earlier point about not in my backyard, if someone comes in and says, I don't think the tower looks very good, it has a substantial adverse effect on my enjoyment of my property, your argument would be, well, it may be unpleasing to you aesthetically, you may think it's an adverse effect, but that's not substantial.
Correct. And in fact, no matter where you try to put a tower, it's always going to be in somebody's backyard, and that's the point.
Well, your response to Justice Ridgely's question, if I understood it correctly, was that substantial means substantial. Is that like pornography? I know it when I see it.
I think to a certain extent the answer there is yes. If there's a little bit of flexibility built into that standard. A substantial. If we had an industrial park, for example, where you could put a cell phone tower, effects that you might find in a residential area as substantial, you might not find to be substantial in an industrial zoned area.
All right, well, I want to digress for just a moment about something in the Superior Court's opinion to just find out whether it's still an issue in this case or relevant. And when this was decided by the Board of Adjustment, one of the reasons the board said that they were going to deny the application is because AT&T could locate its antenna on the Bethany Beach water tower. So under the statute, the rule, you need to look at whether there are viable alternatives, and the board said this is a viable alternative. But then, by the time the Superior Court decided the case, it was a known fact that the town would not allow the antenna to be located on the water tower. And the Superior Court starts its opinion by saying this is somewhat unusual because the board thought the water tower was an option. We all now know the water tower is not an option, but I, the Superior Court judge, am going to go ahead and decide this appeal based on the record before the board. So my question is that dramatic change in the facts and the predicate for one part of the board's ruling relevant in this appeal?
I do not believe it is, Your Honor. We addressed this briefly in our briefs. The Superior Court has the authority to receive additional evidence. Unlike other administrative decisions by other bodies, the Superior Court is granted specific authority to hear and receive additional evidence. And so I think the Superior Court, with respect, erred in assuming that it couldn't consider that that fact.
Well, that becomes a slippery slope, doesn't it? What if the Superior Court considered that evidence? What does it then do, just decide the matter de novo?
Your Honor, the whole review process for Board of Adjustments decisions is somewhat unique in the way it has evolved under Delaware law. And I addressed this briefly in a footnote. The statute says that the Superior Court, and then by analogy this Court, since this Court stands in the shoes of Superior Court, can reverse, modify, or affirm. There's no option for remand under the statute. And I don't think that's an accident. The point is, most Board of Adjustment decisions are being brought, they're being prosecuted by homeowners. They don't have a lot of resources. They don't want to spend a lot of money on whether they can build a 10-foot or 15-foot addition to their house. And so the General Assembly tried to design a very quick and efficient procedure. It said, you go to the board, you get a decision, someone can appeal it to the Superior Court. The Superior Court can receive additional evidence if it wants. It can reverse, affirm, or modify. But what it can't do is remand. And Delaware courts have tried to get around that by saying, well, we're going to reverse the board, but rather than grant you the permit you were seeking, we're just going to say you have to apply all over again, which is the functional equivalent of remand.
Mr. Forston, on another issue that relates really to the factual background, can you clarify whether this, I have the sequence right? I understand that initially this issue came up for a vote and it was approved. And then there was a change of membership of the Board of Adjustment. It came up for a second time, and this time it was the opposite result, and that's what generates this appeal. Is that a correct statement of the sequence?
The sequence was that generally, yes, but the sequence was AT&T applied. It was approved by a vote of 3-2. Now, there was a problem with posting of the property, so the Superior Court ordered a new hearing because the county put the notice on the wrong property. So we had a new hearing, and at that subsequent hearing, the vote was 5-0 against the application. But my recollection, and in fact we checked this morning, the decision was signed by all the same members.
So there wasn't a change
of
membership.
A change of membership. I think what Mr. Witzel might tell you, although I don't want to put words in his mouth, is that at the second hearing, his clients were more prepared. They had more witnesses. There was, 40-some people in attendance complaining about this proposal.
Can you, AT&T obviously must build towers all over the country. Is this particular ordinance, is this a model ordinance? Is it patterned after, to your knowledge, is it patterned after another jurisdiction? Are there any cases interpreting similar ordinances as far as this phrase substantially affect adversely is concerned?
The answer is that land use codes vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Even in this state, the rules aren't exactly the same for Newcastle versus Kent versus Sussex County. What Sussex County did was there are two components to the application here. there are the special requirements that they impose with respect to cell phone towers, how far you have to be set back, demonstrating the need for it and whatnot. Then there's their general special exception requirements that apply to any special exception that you might want to do. That's where this language comes from, the substantially affect adversely. That's in the general requirements applicable to any special exception. But Newcastle County's scheme is different from Kent County's scheme. It's different from what you might have to do in the town of Middletown or the city of Newark. There's wide diversity in some of the cases that are cited in the briefs from other states. You know, some jurisdictions say that a tower has to be designed to be as kind of, I'll say, innocuous or as aesthetically pleasing as possible. There's lots of different standards, and, you know, it's, I guess, one of the benefits of living in a big country with lots of jurisdictions.
When you've been talking about your first argument, which was the correct legal standard, as the court understands your argument, the standard is substantially affect adversely. The decision from the Board of Adjustment left out the word substantially and just said adversely affects. And since that's a lower threshold, your contention is by applying the incorrect lower standard, the decision should be reversed as a matter of law. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that's what this court said in the Hellings case, that if the board applies the incorrect legal standard, it's legal error and should be reversed.
All right, well, let's go to your second argument.
Excuse me, before we do, just to follow up on that question, if we were to reverse as a matter of law, would it then be remanded to the Board of Adjustment for another hearing? Or would it simply be, would it be remanded to the Superior Court then to make an original decision?
Your Honors, I believe the better result would be to go back to Superior Court for original decision. But in the Hellings case, this court said that for now the process was going to be a new application and a new hearing in front of the board. So that's the state of the law under this court's decision in Hellings. I don't think it's proper, given what the statutory language says, but, you know, that's that issue is not on appeal, although I'm happy to.
Well, if we send it back to the Superior Court, what would they do? I mean, you said the standard for the Superior Court is the same for us. If we agree with your argument, they applied the incorrect legal standard and we send it back to the Superior Court, what will it say other than it agrees the incorrect standard was applied, then send it back to the board?
I believe the Superior Court should then make the actual determination, because I believe that's what the statutory scheme actually envisions. I know it's kind of different than what we normally think of as appellate review. I just think that's what the code says.
Well, even if that's correct, the Superior Court, having been reversed, would need some guidance from us. What do we give them in the way of guidance? Other than you've got to now factor in the word substantially. Don't we have to give it some content?
I quoted in our reply brief, I think, what the word substantial means. Bear with me a moment. Our opponents say that substantially simply means actual, existing, and real, not imaginary. That can't be what the word means, because then you wouldn't need it. I mean, if there's an adverse effect, then it must be an actual effect. The word substantial generally is held to mean, of real worth, of considerable value, more than just a minor effect.
Well, for example, would that, if we were to employ that definition, would the court then have to receive evidence on diminution in property values, or hypothetical diminution in property values? That was apparently an issue that was addressed in some form or other at the board level.
Yeah, all of that evidence is already in the record. I think the Superior Court, if it wanted to have questions about the record, it could certainly, I think, fashion whatever procedure it wanted to resolve the question. It could hear additional evidence if it wanted. It could simply review the record and make a decision. In Board of Assessment review cases, where it's all about property values, for a long time the word remand was not in the statute. And so when you appealed to the Superior Court on a property tax assessment case and the court concluded that the board was wrong, the court would then go on to actually set a number as the new assessment based on its review of the evidence in the record. And I think that's what the court should really be doing here. Historically, that's not been the case, and so I know we've gotten away from it. I haven't had a chance to address my second argument.
Well, you're into the time you've reserved. You can use it any way you wish.
Well, let me just take a minute, if I may, to say that in the briefs, I think what we've tried to do is go through the board's decision very carefully and point out the numerous ways in which the board simply ignored the actual evidence before them, credited testimony, which not only, it's not a weight of testimony issue, it's testimony that was actually false and demonstrated not to be true. Dr. Raines, the expert for the opponents, testified that, gee, if AT&T was using directional antenna on its other towers in the area, there wouldn't be a gap and there wouldn't be a need for this tower. That was his testimony. AT&T is already using directional antenna. So that can't be true. The same with the other technological suggestions he made. They were just not technologically feasible, and yet the board credited them.
Does the record show if AT&T's competitors providing cell phone service are already on the towers in the area, and does that allow an inference that it must be needed or the competitors wouldn't be doing it?
Your Honor, the record doesn't really reflect anything about competitors. You know, each, I think, technology is slightly different, and I really can't speak to that particular question.
Well, there was a point in the record where someone said AT&T's remedy was to go to its competitors and ask to share whatever they're using. Is there anything to indicate that that was a viable alternative?
Your Honor, there was testimony from AT&T's engineers. It's part of his job to find other locations and look for other structures. His testimony was there were no other structures that would solve this problem. And there's no reason not to believe that other than opponents don't want to believe it.
You've got a little under 3 minutes.
I would like to reserve my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Witzel. I'm representing and arguing for the Sussex County Board of Adjustment. James Sharp of Moore & Rutt is the attorney for the board. He is at the appellee's table. I'm also representing Sea Pines Village Condominium Association of Owners and several owners within Sea Pines Village who are substantially adversely affected, either way you want to use those words, by this application. Despite the contentions of Mr. Forsten, there are three necessary elements that AT&T had to prove, not just the subjective element of proving no substantial, that their application did not substantially affect adversely neighboring properties. That is the third and most, I contend, subjective element. What AT&T didn't prove from the first pitch of this ballgame was their necessary element of proof of proving that there was no possibility of co-location on any other existing tower within a two-mile radius. Mr. Forsten didn't really talk about that this morning. They have to prove no possibility of co-location.
Well, but I asked him about that.
Facility.
Excuse me. But if you're going to rely on that point, we have this anomalous situation where when the board addressed that, they said, well, you know, AT&T, you say there's no alternative. You could put it on the Bethany Beach water tower. That's what the board thought. But we know by the time of the Superior Court decision, the town had already said, you're not going to put any antenna on our water tower.
Your Honor, we don't have to wander into that muddy water because there's another tower, the South Bethany water tower, upon which Verizon is located, which is within the two-mile radius, that AT&T admitted they never contacted. There is a letter in the record from Bethany, the South Bethany town manager, stating that AT&T never contacted them. In addition, we don't have any correspondence in the files.
Now, where is that in the record? Can you identify where that is?
Yes, Your Honor. That letter is at A92, and that's, excuse me.
Well,
colleague will find that in just a minute, Your Honor.
Well, you can come back to that.
But it is one of the first documents that we submitted into evidence at the public hearing.
Continue with your argument.
Thank you. That letter describes that AT&T had never contacted South Bethany and asked for permission to be on their water tower. There is a co-location requirement in the code that requires that every tower provider have at least two location facilities on their tower. Now, AT&T also has not provided to the board or to the court any explanation why there are not letters from the other cellular providers within the two-mile radius. All of these towers that we're talking about, there's three American Tower company facilities and a Crown radio, a Crown cellular tower facility, all in generally the same vicinity, just west of Bethany Beach.
So you're arguing that apart from all of the other factors that were discussed in Mr. Forrestman's presentation, AT&T had to prove a negative, namely that there was no possibility of co-location. The South Tower at least suggested a possibility of co-location, and the undisputed evidence was that AT&T never contacted anybody to explore that. That's
correct,
the state of the record?
That's correct.
And your argument is on that basis alone we can affirm?
I believe so. I think that's the first strike and they're out. There's not three strikes and you're out. If any one of these is a strike. The second issue...
And what did the Superior Court say about that argument?
The Superior Court found that AT&T, both the board in their articulation, in their oral articulation, and in their written articulation, stated that AT&T had not proven any lack of possibility of co-location. And the Superior Court, at pages 22, 20, 13, and 15, agreed. There was clear evidence in Judge Graves' record that he agreed with the board on that issue. And, Your Honors, that is our strongest point. Your recent decision... just in the past year, of Board of Adjustment of Sussex County v. Francois Verlaison. Justice Ridgely, you'll remember this, you wrote the decision, found that the Sussex County Board of Adjustment lacked the statutory authority to grant the variance to permit construction of a barbecue gazebo, as you may recall, that encroached into a 10-foot setback area where the applicants created their own exceptional practical difficulty. Now, that might seem like it's not connected at all, a variance case and a special exception. But you found that Mr. Francois Verlaison created his own hardship, and you found that that excluded the Board of Adjustment from approving that application. Similarly, in this case, the Board of Adjustment has no statutory authority to approve a cell tower application where the applicant has not proved possibility or availability of location on another tower within a two-mile radius. That, I think, is case dispositive. But I'm not willing to risk my case. Excuse me. Yes, sir.
Going back to Justice Jacobs' point about proving a negative, it seems that the board in this case focused on the water tower in South Bethany as a viable alternative. And when we think about ruling in your favor, we have to think about the precedent we're going to establish. So you seem to say that the applicant needs to think of every conceivable possibility for co-location or independent location and come in, and to the extent someone else says, well, you didn't think about this other possibility, then they lose.
I think that's true, Your Honor. And the legislative history of this ordinance clarifies that. In 2000, in April 2000, the Sussex County Council entertained this ordinance. And the evidence there at the public hearing was that there was a proliferation of cell towers in Sussex County. 200 of them had been approved in the past year or year and a half. And there were 50 more in the hallways waiting to be approved. There were crop dusters who came to the county council hearing and said, enough is enough. In fact, one witness at the hearing said that cell towers are replacing the holly as the state tree. It was a serious situation of overproliferation of cell towers, and that the regulation was passed. Now, you might ask, is that regulation too strenuous? Sussex County Code Section 115.194.2d, which is what we're talking about, has never been attacked as being over-regulatory. The Federal Communication Commission, which is the agency in charge of all of cell tower and cellular communications, has never said, Sussex County, it's too restrictive.
Mr. Witzel,
Yes, sir.
Finish your sentence.
And no one has attacked that in this litigation. They haven't said the ordinance is too restrictive. Instead, AT&T is trying to say that because they can't fulfill their need from that tower, and they have a tower. That's one thing that I want to get to in a minute, Your Honor. Because they can't fulfill their need from that cell tower that is west of Bethany, and they present some evidence that they can't fulfill their need from any of the other towers, then this provision should be waived.
I'd like you to address an issue that came up during Mr. Forsten's presentation, the procedural question.
Yes,
about whether or not there can be a remand to the board, or whether, in the event of a reversal, the only institution that can correct the error is the Superior
yes.
Court. What is the board's position on that issue, if any?
Your Honor, although my clients behind me don't want to hear this, I think the only remedy, the only result, is that the application is, the denial is reversed, and AT&T files a reapplication with the Board of Adjustment. And we go through this whole process all over again at great expense to people who, Mr. Forsten say, are only complaining about a NIMBY argument having this in their own backyard. They would have to spend thousands, tens of thousands of dollars on experts again to fight AT&T, who obviously has plenty of funds.
So there seem to be three options floating around here. One is the Superior Court will make a new decision in the first instance. A second is that there could be a remand in the context of the current proceeding without having to refile. And the third is a complete start, a do-over.
Yes, Your Honor. I it's my personal opinion, having practiced zoning for quite a while, that I think that the remedy would be to start all over again, which reminds me of one point that you brought up. That from a procedural point of view, this application process started back in 2009 when AT&T applied for the same exact facility. And the county posted the wrong property. It was an entirely procedural error by the county. The board didn't listen to the people who came to object at that meeting, that first public hearing. My clients were not represented by counsel. They didn't hire experts. They didn't have appraisers. They didn't hire an RF engineer. Very few people showed up. And AT&T ran them over. They just presented the exact same evidence that they presented today. I was able to get that decision reversed on a procedural aspect. And when we started this application, the board members, the chairman of the board, looked at us during the presentation of our hearing and said, this is really an entirely new application. You're prepared. You have your experts, and they were astounded.
Would you address the absence of the word substantially in the board's decision?
Yes, Your Honor. We think it's a matter of semantics. Substantial means actual, having value. Substantial evidence is more than a scintilla and less than a preponderance. It's more than a trace, but less than a tipping of the scales. It's certainly not clear and convincing evidence. It's not evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
It's an empty vessel, right?
It is a trace.
Right, but you're conflating two things. The burden of proof.
Yes, sir.
Which is substantial evidence. But then the question is, substantial evidence of what. And the what is either an adverse effect or a substantial adverse effect. They're not the same. So let me give you a hypothetical and have you apply it. When we talk about directors' fiduciary duties and we talk about care, we know that care means gross negligence, not simple negligence. And if the Court of Chancery said, I think the directors were negligent, but didn't say they were grossly negligent, is that a semantic difference or a substantive difference?
I would agree that's a substantive difference, Your Honor.
But when you say there's an adverse effect as opposed to substantially affect adversely, substantially is insignificant.
Substantially means real, having actual existence.
No, but my question is, what's the difference in leaving out the word gross when the standard involves negligence and leaving out the word substantial when the question is adverse effect?
I understand your point. It's very interesting to look carefully at Section 10 of the Board's decision. In that last sentence, where they did not state the difficult terminology in the negative of substantially affect adversely. In the first part of that sentence, they said, we believe the testimony of the applicants who provided substantial and significant evidence. And, Your Honors, there was substantial evidence of serious injury to my clients. I haven't got to that yet, but I'd like to get there at some point. I believe that the Board just couldn't put those words together consecutively, but they're there in that last sentence.
Now, is this? Do you agree with the other side that this statute or ordinance is unique, or is it derived from a model ordinance somewhere?
I looked into that, Your Honor, and I can't find a uniform code that uses that language in such a negative and difficult fashion. I practiced it many times before I came before Your Honors to just say those three words together. And I think it's reasonable to understand that laypersons who serve on these boards without money could get confused by that. But if you look at their findings in paragraphs 4, 5, 6, 7 through 10, they address serious harm that they feel would be caused to my clients. And has
so
been
was the decision that we're talking about with this language announced at the meeting at the conclusion, the lay people just started talking, or did they take the matter under advisement?
They took the matter under advisement, and they came back 2 weeks later for an oral decision, and then a written decision was made.
So when they had the matter under advisement, they had an opportunity to consult with their own attorney.
Yes.
And notwithstanding that consultation, didn't come up with the applicable standard from the statute.
We don't agree that it's not the applicable standard. We believe that Judge Graves used the proper standard in determining all of the evidence before him on the record, as he's entitled to do, and finding that there was evidence of substantial adverse effect.
Well, was the argument made of failure to apply the correct legal standard to Judge Graves, and did he address that?
Yes, he did. And he reached that conclusion.
And now, the definition of substantially
affect adversely,
according to Judge Graves, is what?
That my clients, from the temporary tower that's presently in effect, and from all of the evidence presented by our experts, appraisal experts, RF engineers, laypersons, real estate agents, or that the real estate values...
I think you misunderstand my question. Did he define the phrase?
No, he did not. He used the magic language. And we don't believe it's a Hellings case. We don't believe that that changes the standard to an easier standard. If I may, I'd like to address... First of all, what substantial is not, and it's not imaginary, and it's not apparitional, and it's not seeming, and it's not illusory, and it's not hypothetical, and it's not conjecture. That's your definition in Oceanport v. Wilmington Stevedores when there was an issue of standing, and the participants had to allege substantial injury, not substantial adverse effect, but that they were substantially affected. Those are the definition terms. And we contend that what my clients presented to the board and what I argued to Superior Court was not hypothetical and not conjecture, but real damage. Our appraisers, who the board chose to believe, as they're entitled to, as the weighers of the evidence, found that there was between a 10 and 30% diminution in property values as a result of this application. There is a temporary tower there as a result of the first hearing. My clients experienced the damage and the injury from that temporary tower. This is not illusory. There's an 80-foot wooden tower there with a light on it and a cellular facility and electronic equipment that's been there for a year and a half. They've experienced that. They testified about that at the second hearing. Mr. Rafael, our MIT and Harvard-trained radio frequency engineer, discussed all of the potential damage that could occur from a tower like this, lightning strikes. If you look at the record carefully, as far-reaching as my adversary would like it to be, there is testimony and videotapes of cell towers catching on fire and falling. I have at least five clients who are within the actual fall zone of this tower. The tower is 100 feet, and my clients' residences are within 70 to 75 feet of the base of that tower. That is potential catastrophic injury. That's not illusory. In addition, the property owners talked about their diminution in value, their inability to rent their properties in the summer because of the existence of the temporary tower. I see my light is on and I have 6 seconds. I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Your Honors, thank you. Let me respond really quickly to some of the things Mr. Witzel said, because with respect, I don't think the record bears him out at all. First off, there's testimony in the record that the South Bethany Tower doesn't solve this problem. So when Mr. Witzel says, oh, they didn't tell us they couldn't go to the South Bethany Tower, yeah, we didn't tell them that because we said we couldn't use it. Even if we could go there, it wouldn't solve this problem.
So how do we resolve this dispute? He's telling us there's a record in evidence that says you never considered the South Bethany Tower, and you appear to be telling us that the record shows there was testimony to the effect that the South Bethany Tower wasn't an option, so therefore that's why you didn't call them?
Correct. Exactly right. He's complaining we didn't show evidence that we contacted South Bethany. There was no point in our contacting South Bethany because locating on their water tower would not solve this problem. That's in the record.
But isn't that still a requirement of proof under the ordinance?
Your Honor, we had our, first of all, why are we here? We're here today because AT&T needs to solve a gap in its coverage. We have chosen to put up a tower in this location because having investigated lots of options or possible options or trying to find an option, this is the solution. It would be much easier, much cheaper, much quicker to simply go on somebody else's tower. And if that was a solution, we would have done it.
Well, we're just trying to determine what your response is to the argument.
Well, the argument is,
the other side says is dispositive of this appeal.
Well, I don't believe Mr. Witzel is being fair. We had our employees there, whose job it is to find locations, saying they drew the circle, they looked at all the possible locations, and they determined which ones would work. They talked to those property owners, and they ended up with this being the only location that would work. There were no existing structures we could go on.
Okay, so you're saying the evidence, that is the state of the record?
Yes.
And by implication, the other possibilities were disproved. That is, you know, the requirement was satisfied, you
exactly,
know, by the testimony that this is the only one.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor.
I'm getting confused. I'd like you to help me understand this. One issue is what the ordinance requires that there be proof of or proof that there is not. Another issue is the technology and what is going to meet AT&T's needs. There may or may not be overlap. As I understand the other side's argument, the ordinance requires proof of no possibility of co-location within a 2-mile radius. And that was either proven or not. So was it proven?
Your Honor, the statute says no possibility of co-location on an existing structure that solves the problem. In other words, it doesn't do us any good to put something on the town of South Bethany's tower, because even if we put something there, we would still have the gap in coverage north of Bethany Beach. And we're trying to solve the coverage problem north of Bethany Beach. And we presented testimony that we investigated all the properties in the area. Now, some didn't work because they weren't in the right location. Some didn't work because property owners didn't want to have anything to do with us. AT&T would much prefer to go on an existing structure if that solved the problem. They wouldn't have spent money on engineers, on lawyers, on other experts, spent years in this process if they could simply locate on another tower. And Justice Jacobs had it exactly right. How do you prove a negative? Well, we had witnesses there who testified to that fact. The board didn't ask them further questions. And I think it's very unfair to say you need to give us 200 letters and, you know, a report this thick to demonstrate you talked to everybody in a 2-mile radius. A lot of those properties wouldn't even satisfy the problem here, trying to address this gap in coverage.
Thank you. Your time's expired.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's more I could say, but thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court found them very helpful. We're going to take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.